Hello, everyone, and welcome to Untangled Resolution's presentation of The Problem is the Answer. I am your host, Fatabile Mtombeni, and I'm coming to you from Tropical Storm Irene's living room here in Harlem, USA. This show has been pre-recorded for your convenience. Today, I am happy to welcome Pankaj Amin back to the show. He is our expert on the economy and on how to thrive in these financially challenging times. Today, we talk about why this recession is different from any other and how to stand out in a tough economy. This is not your grandmother's recession, and whether you are looking for regular employment or offering your services as a subcontractor, it is a buyer's market, and the competition among sellers is stiff. How do you make sure that your resume or proposal gets to the top of the pile? Listen to the show to hear what you need to know. In honor of Irene, I am presenting music from Roz Moshe's album, Into the Openness. You are listening to an excerpt of part one from a piece called Journey Through the Cosmic Blue Night Forest. A number of people have asked me, how do you listen to this stuff? It doesn't make sense. My answer is, it is sense. It is about sensing and the senses. It is about what nature sounds like. So sit back and listen while everyone gathers. See whether you recognize the sounds of the cosmic blue night forest. I'll be back with you in just a moment. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. I'm here with Pankaj Amin, who is returning to the show as a guest. And we're talking today about why this recession is different from the Great Depression and what that means in terms of your strategies and your behaviors going forward. We understand that this is not your grandmother's depression. And so things being different means that you have to use different strategies than perhaps were employed in the past. So, Pankaj, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Good, awesome. I'm always glad to have you here. Talk to me about why this is not your grandmama's recession.
Well, you know, it's a really interesting, Batabalia. I think that structurally, we are in a different place as a country, and our population is in a different place than back in the 1930s. So, for example, in the 1930s, a majority of our population was involved in agriculture. Today, in 2011, maybe 1% or 2% of our country's population is involved in agriculture. So the composition of what people do for a living is totally different from 70 years ago. So specifically, if you lost your job back in the Great Depression, a safety net for people, even if they didn't have unemployment insurance and a lot of the other programs that we have as a government today, you could always go back to the farm and tend to your garden, right? Today, that's not necessarily an option for a lot of people if you live in a suburban environment, if you live in the desert, which has now been developed and populated. So who we are as a country is different from the 1930s. Number two, the balance sheet of both our families and our country is also different. Back in the 1930s, credit was not nearly as available to families, especially at the lower and lower middle income level. And the country didn't have nearly as much debt as it does now. And those two things really when you take on debt, either as a family or a company or a country, what you're doing is you're saying, I'm borrowing from the future, my future performance, mm-hmm. to get that capital today, either to make an investment or make a purchase or give out benefits as a country. What you're doing is you're really making the assumption that your performance as that entity is going to continue for another X period of time. If that doesn't happen, then you have to make more dramatic cuts like we're seeing in Europe, uh-huh. in order to fund, quote unquote, the activity that you had banked on.
Right.
So those are two major differences between the last depression and this depression,
right.
and it really has major consequences for us.
Right. So those are pressures that didn't exist back then. Like you said, you could always go back to the farm. You could grow tomatoes in the backyard. You could feed yourself without having to rely on going to the store. And then people just didn't have as much debt.
Right. So if you lost your job and you didn't have debt, well, you can dramatically cut your costs,
mm-hmm.
and maybe still survive. But if you've taken, in today's world, if you've taken on a lot of debt and you lose your job, well, you can't just, you can either default on your debt or you have to make even more dramatic cuts in other parts of your life or your operations in order to fund repaying that debt that you've already taken on.
Right. So then that means significant things in terms of the kinds of options that are available to people today and the kinds of activity that they must be involved in order to continue to survive. Having a job, remaining employed, finding employment is that much more important in this economy than it was back then.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the major consequences, which we're already seeing, is that there are a number of professions and industries where we've made the assumption that jobs would exist, and not only are they gone, but they quite possibly will be gone at the level that we've seen them recently forever. So for example, construction was a major beneficiary of the housing boom in 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006.
Right.
And what we saw was, if you look at new home sales data, which that number just for this month came out this past week. So when you look at new home sales as essentially a proxy for how robust or how active the construction industry is, because you're taking out the existing homes that have already been built and sold in the market. When you look at just new home sales, the number that was released this past week was the lowest annual run rate in recorded history. And we have been recording this data since 1963. So just to give you a little bit of specifics, even in 1963, when the population was dramatically lower than it is now, there were approximately, if I'm not mistaken, about 375,000 new homes sold in 1963. If you come forward all the way to today, the annual run rate of homes sold last month was less than 300,000. I think it was 280,000.
Wow.
So we're seeing numbers that we haven't seen ever, and numbers that would even be low in prior recessions or in a much smaller economy, because in 1963 we had a smaller
economy.
You've
got a bigger population, you have more people, and still the home sales are lower than they have ever been.
Yeah, new home sales.
New
and
home
I think
sales,
what we're
right.
doing, so why is, there's two things that points coming out of that. Number one is, well, why is that happening?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's happening because A, people don't have cash to buy these houses, and they can't get loans to buy these houses.
Mm-hmm.
Banks don't want to give you a loan because a loan is essentially a promise on future performance, and that future performance, as we just mentioned, is much more uncertain than it was
mm-hmm.
5 years ago.
Right.
And then number two, the second point coming out of that information is, well, if I'm someone who works in construction, what do I do? And the unfortunate reality is, in 2006, when there was a million or a million and a half new homes sold,
mm-hmm.
versus today when there's less than 300,000, you have to really look in the mirror and say, well, that construction job that I had before may never come back, or it may be so long before it comes back that I can't wait that out. I need to figure out something else that I need to do. And so that's the reality, and it's really hard for a lot of people because there's a form of almost desperation that I think a lot of folks are feeling. And if you feel that way, then you're not alone,
mm-hmm.
because they have a certain skill set, but it's just not needed in the marketplace anymore. And so how do you retool yourself so that you can make yourself relevant? That's the big challenge for a lot of folks today.
Well, we'll get into this topic of retooling yourself, which is the main topic of the show today. The purpose of doing these shows is to provide information that can help folks to be able to overcome the challenges that we're facing with the economy. So I'm very eager to get into that. I do want to ask you about this, though. You know, you talk about the very small chances of jobs coming back and jobs coming back soon, mm-hmm. At least in certain industries. And I hear sometimes from folks who were around in the 70s, for example, when the economy tanked as well, who experienced the 80s. And, you know, where things came back and we had quite a bit of a boom. And it was a boom that kind of lasted. There were some troughs, but it wasn't what it is today. It seems as though your forecast is a little more negative or dire than it might have been considering what happened in the 70s. So there are those who said, you know what, we've been here before.
Mm-hmm.
We've been here
before. So let
me
tell you why I think the situation is slightly different.
Okay.
In the 1970s, you're right, we had high inflation, we had an unemployment problem, but the interest rates, what we did in 1980 or 1981 is the Federal Reserve dramatically increased interest rates in the early 80s under Volcker as the chairman of the Federal Reserve. He was able to do that back then. That caused a lot of immediate pain to the economy.
Mm-hmm.
We experienced a fairly sharp and dramatic recession in that period, right at the beginning of Reagan's administration, and then it immediately subsided.
Okay.
What that did is it flushed out a lot of, in my opinion, a lot of excesses in the system.
Okay.
And then allowed us to regrow anew. And that's why we saw a really robust recovery in the 1980s. Unfortunately, the difference between that environment and where we are today is that the amount of debt that the United States government has is dramatically higher than it was back in the 1970s. The consequent reality of that is that our interest payments just on our interest today at rock bottom interest rates is borderline unsustainable.
Mm.
So the notion of us increasing rates to 12, 15, 20%, whatever it is, to try and pierce the bubble of the issues that we have would be unthinkable for the United States government given the amount of debt that they have to pay interest on. So I believe that the Federal Reserve and other folks in the government actively try and steer us away from a monetary policy that would maybe have some upfront pain and then a recovery later on, because quite frankly, the federal government itself is not in a position to withstand that pain.
My goodness.
So that's the fundamental difference between where we were in the 70s and where we are today. So what I believe is going to happen is Ben Bernanke has himself stated in the last couple of weeks that we are going to keep with these emergency 0 to 0.25% interest rates for at least the next 2 years, which puts us into the middle of 2013. The Wall Street was fairly calmed by that because that was at least some certainty as to where interest rates are going to be, mm-hmm. in the medium term.
So they can do some planning.
But what that does mean is that we're not going to flush out some of these excesses that we have. That's, in my opinion, that's what needs to happen in order for us to get back to what we, a 1970s, 1980s scenario.
So we can't
have that.
We can't have a 70s recovery.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Now, I'd love to be proven wrong.
Well, right. I'm right with you on that one. I would love for you to be proven wrong as well. So we want to start talking then about what folks can do to weather this period of time that's not going to look like the 30s, it's not going to look like the 70s. We don't know what it's going to look like. So part of the stress of everything is the uncertainty. And I want people to be able to sort of ignore uncertainty and create their own certainty. One of the things that we keep talking about is that one cannot rely on the assurance of having a job. in order to make a living, that even if you have a job, it's not necessarily going to provide you everything that you need in order to pay your rent and the food and, you know, send kids to school if you have children and so forth and so on. So let's talk a bit about strategies that folks can employ if they are looking for work, if they're looking to retool themselves into a different profession or to be able to provide services in a way that they hadn't before. But, so let's get started. Where do you want to start?
Yeah, so let's, you know, and I think you, starting with the context that we just did is important, because if you do believe that the economy is not necessarily going to get better, then now you can start planting that strategy with that in mind. And one of the things that I think everyone needs to look at is, how do you minimize your current costs?
Okay.
And this is a strategy whether you are employed or whether you're not employed. Even if you have a job, if you're one of the folks who's lucky enough to have a job and you say, okay, I'm going to be as valuable as possible to my employer, you should also proactively look at your life and say, can I cut some costs out? And as an owner of a business myself, when I bought my telecom company in California, I thought it was pretty well run. It was pretty well run when I got in there, but I was still able to cut costs in a variety of places in that business. For your family or for your personal situation, you should also be able to do the same thing. Can you cut your rent down? Can you cut your food expenses down? Can you cut your car expenses down? Can you cut your entertainment expenses down? There are a lot of things that you can maybe proactively do, even if you have a job, and that will just give you more of a cushion or a buffer so that if you do have a problem or if the economy doesn't get better, you're in a better place to weather that storm.
Well, so it sounds like you're suggesting that people actually sit down, get some paper, get a pen, you know, look at your bank statements, look at your receipts. Where are you spending? How much are you spending? And be very diligent about,
yeah,
you know.
And if you're, and for a lot of people, it's really scary to open up their bank statement. They,
yeah,
don't want to look at their bank statement, and it goes straight into a drawer as soon as,
sure,
it comes in the mail. They don't even open up the envelope.
Yeah.
But you do need to just pony up to the table and say, "Look, I'm gonna open up this bank statement. I'm gonna come up with a budget. I want to see if I am adhering to my budget." One way you can do that pretty easily, if you don't even have a budget, which a lot of people don't, every time you pay for anything over the next month, from September 1st to September 30th, write it down.
Mm-hmm.
Every single thing that you spend, write it down.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the month, you'll at least have a record of where you spent your money, because some people don't even know where they spent their money. And these are basic things. I mean, basic things that you can do whether you're employed or not. In a bad economy, in a good economy, you should know how you're spending your money. But once you have that on paper, then you can go through and line item and say, you know what, I think we should be a little bit more economical in this, and this area.
You know, there are tools that are available for folks who have internet access and who use debit or debit credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
There's Mint.com, for example, which is free.
Yep.
It's through Quicken, I believe. And so it actually links to your bank account, and it can give you a weekly report that is, you know, based on information that you give it to tell you whether you are keeping to your budget. So you can construct a budget online. It tells you whether you're sticking to your budget or not, and it allows you to, you know, be flexible, make shifts here and there until you find a budget that actually works for you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one of the things that's kind of painful is that I think folks got used to having ready credit available, to being spontaneous, you know, to be able to go to the grocery store without a list, for example. Now, making a list and sticking to it is really important. So changing that kind of behavior, changing your fiscal behavior, is one of the steps that you're recommending for people to retool themselves for this economy.
Yeah, and step one would be to know what you're spending your money on currently. Step two would be where can you cut?
Mm-hmm.
And then step three is how do you go about cutting?
Okay.
And I think that everyone should be using tools that you're, like the tools that you've mentioned, everyone should be using something like that to at least understand where they're getting their money and where they're spending their money.
Right.
And then number two, if you're relying on a credit card, and financial advisors have been saying this since the dawn of credit cards, do not spend something on a credit card if you don't think you can pay it off at the end of the month.
Oh, yes.
If you're carrying,
right,
a revolving balance on your credit card, that now the red lights are flashing. Now is when you should be actively trying to get rid of that.
Right. Oh, I'm actually should then explain. When I said debit credit card, I'm not talking about your, you know, American Express card or your MasterCard, but there are cards that your bank can give you that go directly to your bank account.
Sure, sure.
And so you're not, you know, borrowing money and you're not paying interest on it. It is coming straight out of your bank account.
And unfortunately, Batavli, Wells Fargo just announced this past week too, is that they're introducing additional fees because of the limits on fees that they can charge based on regulation that came out a year ago.
Yeah.
They're now charging additional fees on debit card transaction activity.
But if you use it as a credit card. I mean, I'm going to tell you, maybe this is changing as well, but I'll you know, be out there and tell you what my strategy is, which I think works really well for me. So, you know, I have an account with my bank that gives me rewards for every time I use my debit card as a credit card rather than using it as a debit card. So I don't enter a PIN number. I ask the merchant to bill it as a credit card. There are no fees for doing that, at least at this moment, and I get points. I haven't purchased a single Christmas present in the last 3 years. What I do is that I don't touch my points. I let my points rack up throughout the year. And then at the end of the year, I use my points to buy Christmas presents.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're probably fairly disciplined about how you go about spending money.
Yes.
So what you just need to remember is for someone who may, or you know, and everybody who's listening needs to just look in the mirror and be honest with themselves, okay? But if you're not as disciplined, I know that, you know, I'm not as disciplined. If you're not as disciplined about how you spend your money
mm-hmm.
using a debit card, the last thing you want to do is hit an overdraft fee
yes.
or an, you know, some type of overdraft charge or
right.
some type of other types of transactional fees that your bank may or may not charge you.
Right.
So that, but I think that there, that I do think using a debit card is one way to monitor and track your spending
mm-hmm.
and then as you're doing, potentially get some rewards.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that if you can't survive for at least 6 months to a year without a job, and you have a job right now, you need to be saving up to have
type
of cushion.
Right.
So that if you do lose your job tomorrow, you're not scrambling around, because the amount of time that people are looking for jobs in between jobs nowadays is getting longer and longer. You have to assume that you might be out of a job for a year
mm-hmm.
just so that you can have that cushion so that you're not in dire financial straits.
Right.
Now, should we move on to people who maybe don't have a job?
Sure. Let's talk about people who don't have a job.
Those, you know, if you don't have a job and let's say you're a construction worker,
mm-hmm.
and that's because we used that example earlier today, you really need to look at your skill set more broadly. And I think everybody in this environment is a salesperson. You're selling your own services. Whether you're looking for a job, you're looking for clients, you're looking for whatever, you're a salesperson and you need to really understand what it means to sell.
Right.
And what I mean by that is if you're a construction worker and you are looking for construction jobs and nobody is hiring for construction jobs because people aren't building new houses right now, well, what you really need to do is then do an inventory of your own skill set and say, how can I take what I do have skills in, because everybody has skills, and marry that with what people are looking to hire for
yeah.
or what people are looking to buy.
Right.
Because and it's very difficult to do the second thing, which is you cannot get emotionally trapped in the notion of, well, nobody wants to hire me for what I want to do. If you can't sell, and salespeople are inherently very good at this. I worked at an enterprise software company back in San Francisco, like a million years ago. And software is a very, especially enterprise B2B software, is very sales driven.
Right.
And those sales folks, they're looking for something that they can sell. And once they find something that they can sell, they run with it. But they don't take it personally if the product that they have is not sellable. As a matter of fact, they'll come back to marketing and say, this product is not sellable. Give me something I can sell.
Exactly. We need to retool it.
So you have to think of yourself as that type of a person when you're looking for a job. You're out there looking to sell something, which is a skill set and an experience set that you have. And if it's not selling, you have to go back to your quote-unquote internal marketing folks, which is yourself, and say, how do I retool or reposition or repackage the skill set that I have to be relevant to the people who are out there looking for things? Or is there some additional piece of education or additional piece of skill that I need to go and acquire in order to be really relevant for someone? And the only thing is I caution people on going back and just getting another education. Education is expensive, and you know, education is a good thing for a lot of reasons,
right.
But if you go off and get the wrong education that nobody really wants to hire you for, then you're really just spinning your wheels and wasting your time, and unfortunately for a lot of people, potentially taking on a lot more debt.
Exactly. So it can end up actually making the problem bigger.
That's right.
Once
you
end up coming out of school.
Knowing what people want to hire for is the most important thing, and then figuring out how you can position yourself in that world.
So
because even then it's hard.
Well, right. But you know, then it's a matter of being far more strategic about how you go about your job search, far more analytical. It's not about sending out 1,000 resumes, which you can now with the internet. It's a lot easier. You've got monster.com
yep.
and jobs.com and so forth. So finding the openings
is easier, right? Here's the deal.
From the hiring perspective,
exactly. When I was hiring someone, if I wanted to hire a technician,
mm-hmm.
I would put up an ad on monster.com,
mm-hmm.
and in 2 days, I would have 300 resumes.
Wow.
At least,
yeah.
Right? There was one time when I was hiring an office manager, which was a relatively low-paid position,
uh-huh.
And I put an ad up on either Craigslist or Monster.com,
yeah.
and I had 300 resumes, people who had graduate degrees looking for this job that you could have done out of high school. So that's the market. And so if you're out there looking for jobs, what I would say is, yes, it is easy to go in and throw 1,000 resumes in at Monster.com. However, every single resume that you throw in, remember that there's 1,000 other people applying for that same position. Because the barrier to entry, the barrier to throw that resume is so low that people are just throwing resumes all over the place.
Okay.
And then as the employer, it's now my job to go sift through all those resumes to find
the one
or the three that I really want to bring in for an interview.
Right.
And guess what? If I have 1,000 resumes to look through, how much time am I really going to spend on each one resume?
Right. So why don't we do this? We're going to take a little bit of a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about how you can stand out. We'll also talk about folks who decide that they're not going to go to the job market to find work, but that they're going to create work.
Great.
And that's really where I want to focus when we come back, is creating work. So we'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you. ababyeyi banjye ndashaka kuririmbo indirimbo zo sogokuru yarazi none reka nzimuhira ntahe reka ningire ahashyushye heza kandi umunsi reka nzimuhire hari amahoro amahoro amahoro
Welcome back to the show, everybody. You are listening to Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a show about the personal, social, and financial issues that concern you most. I am your host, Batabi Lebentombini, relationship coach and divorce mediator, broadcasting from Harlem, USA. Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in couples and divorce mediation. If you have an issue that just won't go away, work it out in couples mediation. If ending a relationship is your healthiest choice, I will guide the process so that you don't lose your shirt or your mind. Work out your child support and parenting issues without spending years in court. For more information, visit my website, www.123untangled.com. That is www.123untangled.com, or write to me at info@123untangled.com. That's info, I-N-F-O, at 123untangled.com, and never fear, that email comes straight to me, so you will hear directly from me. You have just heard the marvelously talented singer and songwriter, Somi. The song is called Even If the Rains Come First, and it is from her album, also called Even If the Rains Come First. I invite you to check out Somi's music on iTunes, where she now has 3 wonderful albums available for purchase. I have the privilege of being on the board of directors for the Peace of Heart Choir, and I am delighted to introduce the choir to you. As the choir's website explains, the Peace of Heart Choir is a not-for-profit collective of musical community members who came together in response to the tragic events of September 11, 2001, to help promote healing, diversity, community bonding, and mutual understanding through music. Some choir members were responders, some lost loved ones. All were deeply affected and moved to bring comfort and healing to the people of New York City. As part of the choir's mission, they perform music from around the world at more than 20 free on-site concerts a year for area shelters, hospitals, hospices, youth organizations, service providers, and other nonprofits in the New York metropolitan area. The choir has planned a special series of performances to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the September 11th tragedy. Please mark your calendars. Friday, September 9th, from 5:30 to 6 o'clock p.m., the choir will be at Merchants Gate,
Central Park South and West 59th Street. On Saturday, September 10th, from 1 o'clock to 2:30 in the afternoon, they will be at the Fire Museum of the FDNY. It is at 278 Spring Street. The choir will perform for about 20 minutes as one of five groups at this event. On Sunday, September 11th, from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the choir will present a special hour-long concert at Castle Clinton in Battery Park. All events are free and open to the public. I truly encourage you to go to at least one of these performances. You will not be disappointed. If you have a community event that you would like me to announce on the show, please send me notice for my consideration at least 3 weeks in advance. All right, everyone, let's get back to the show. Okay, we're back, and Pankaj, I'm happy to have you here on the show. I'm here with Pankaj Amin, who is a return guest to the show, and I'm really grateful that he has agreed to come back a number of times, actually. We're going to have him here regularly, and I hope to have you here at least once a month so that we can talk about the economy, talk about strategies that folks can use to weather this particular difficult time in the world economy. Actually, I was going to say the American economy, but it is the world economy. And I do know that I have people who are listening around the world, so I'm hoping that some of the information that you give, even though it has some of a sort of a local flavor to it as far as the United States is concerned, they can find some strategies, information, things that can be helpful to them overseas as well. Before we went to the break, we were talking a bit about how folks can strategize their job search, and also I'd like to talk a bit about how folks can deal with a situation where they decide that trying to go back into the job market really isn't what's going to work for them. They're going to try to create the work. So those are the two major areas I'd like us to cover. But let's talk a bit about resumes. You talked about how as a business owner, you would put out job listings and get a ton of resumes back, 300 resumes for one position.
Yep.
And you know, in that situation, a business owner doesn't really have a lot of time to be looking carefully at each resume. So let's talk about how a person can stand out as they sell themselves in this job market.
Okay, so here's what I would suggest. And as a hiring professional, I can tell you that I hired people more, you were much more likely to get hired if you were referred in through somebody who already worked there.
Okay.
So for example, I had a technician who said, hey, are you looking at hiring? Here is someone else who you may want to consider. I've worked with him previously and he's really great. I'm now getting a reference and I'm also saving a lot of time.
Yes.
Because when you're when you're a business person and you've got 1,000 things to do, sifting through a whole box of resumes is not really your top priority in life, right? So you want to get out there and sell to your customers, and if you can expeditiously get someone in to do the work that you're looking to hire for, you're going to do that. And if you have a reference from someone who you already trust within the company, that's even better.
So use your network is basically what you're saying.
Absolutely. And what I would say is the mistake that I find a lot of people doing is they will spend 5 hours a day throwing resumes out on monster.com, and then they think that they have been productive. I would say that that is only one leg of your three-legged stool, okay? Yes, you might get something out of that, but you can get a lot of different resumes in, but you have a lot of competition. The other two legs are really focused on networking. So, and some of it is social media based, and some of it is just good old-fashioned networking. So let's talk about social media based first. If you know that you want to work for, pick a company, Clorox, and if you know you want to work for Clorox, right, and you live in Oakland and you love the company, you love their products, you think you're an outstanding candidate for that company, go on to LinkedIn. If you have a LinkedIn account and if you can find people who work for that company, or maybe people in your network who know people who work for that company who you can get introduced to, that would be a great way for you to do informational interviews. Try to get in front of the right people so that you can be the person who's coming in outside of the mass of resumes in the box. So, and the more you can do that, the more likely you are to get into a company.
So it's not just sending out the paper or sending out the email. Face-to-face still really matters.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the second leg of that three-legged stool, or the third leg, I guess, is good old-fashioned networking.
Uh-huh.
If you know you want to be in if you want to do marketing work, then go and join the industry associations or the professional associations that are specific to your industry and your skill set, and get out there and meet people.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you, and frankly, more than just go to the breakfast, get involved and become involved in that association.
Right.
If it's an association that's really relevant to your profession, you should be getting involved in that anyway. And
mm-hmm.
now is a good opportunity to get involved in the back behind the scenes,
right,
so that you're involved with the planning and the organization, because that's where you get to know how people work. And that's where people will get to know how you work, and that's when they'll be more comfortable referring you into different people who could potentially hire you.
Right.
So that's ultimately, you want to show people the quality and the level caliber of the work that you provide, rather than sending them a resume. Because when you send them a resume, it gets lost in the shuffle.
Uh-huh.
But if you can get out there and establish relationships with people and also demonstrate the type of work that you do, that's where you're going to shine, and then also get the reference into a company so that you're bypassing everybody else who's just sending in a resume.
Right. And even if you're not in a situation where you can perhaps join the management of the organization and do the back work, which is really, really important, I have found that to be very helpful, you know, to be part of planning committees and so forth. That's really important. But I've also found that with networking groups and networking events where I'm more casually involved, I make it a point to try to schedule coffee with at least two people that I meet at each place that I go to.
That's exactly right.
Right. So, you know, that's another way then of getting to know people personally.
Mm-hmm. And what I would suggest in that coffee situation, because all of us are salespeople who are going to have that coffee, you know, that coffee talk,
mm-hmm.
then what I would suggest is, number one, you need to have a very succinct and clear description. I call it an elevator pitch, but you need to have a clear elevator pitch of what you're looking for,
mm-hmm.
and who you're looking to meet.
Okay.
So, for example, hi, my name is John. I'm a marketing consultant. I've helped Fortune 500 companies over the last 15 years. I'm looking to do work as a marketing consultant in the pharmaceuticals industry in New Jersey.
Very specific,
because then a lot of times,
even location specific.
Sure, unless you're interested in moving, right?
Sure.
I mean, if that's not a parameter for you, the last thing you want is to get a job in Ohio and say, well, I don't really want to move to Ohio because I have to take my kids out of school and I have to do X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
So the more specific you can be up front about helping people give you the right information or the right lead, the more likely they are to be able to give you that. And this is counterintuitive, because I think a lot of people will say, well, if I keep my options open, then I'll get anything. What I find is the exact opposite. If you keep your options open in that coffee talk, the person at the other side of the table doesn't really know what you're looking for, and then therefore gives you nothing instead of what you're looking for.
Exactly.
So be specific. And then number two, when you go into that coffee talk or that informal meeting with someone, go into that meeting from the perspective of, how can I help this person? Because they're coming to you with something that they're looking to achieve as well.
Sure.
The more likely that you are, if you can go in and understand what they're looking to accomplish, either with you or in general, then the more likely you are able to attract their attention and maintain their attention for a period of time where you're actually going to get a good relationship from them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to get their trust, and they'll open up their maybe more inner circle of recommendations to you. They're not going to just give out a recommendation to their most, you know, their innermost trusted personnel to someone who they don't even know. So that's, you really have to go to those coffee talks from the perspective of, how can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you're going to get the most beneficial information and leads back.
Right. I've also found in networking that being able to be personable and sort of shoot the breeze during the coffee talk is important as well. And it's something that didn't occur to me right at the beginning. I thought it was all about business.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're pointing out is that really it's about relationships, and that relationships are built on more than just the business interests between you. People tend to sell to people that they know and they like, right?
That's exactly right.
And so,
and if you're selling, which you're looking for a job, you're selling.
Yeah.
You need to be approachable. You need to be pleasant. You need to be knowledgeable. You need to be flexible. You need to be looking at how you can help the other person in whatever capacity you can.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, you will get the fruits of relationships and connections back.
Right.
It will come naturally at that point. And what it's interesting because anyone who is a CEO or a business owner is a salesperson. They're all on the street trying to sell something. And so what I've found is a lot of people find selling to be intimidating and to be awkward. What you need to do is diffuse that by figuring out how to make it fun and social and interesting and enjoyable. And professional associations, these informational meetings, those are all things that you can do. And there's one other thing which I do want to mention, which is if you don't want to go to that association meeting because you find it intimidating, take your friend with you.
Oh, yes.
Okay. It is a lot easier to have a glass of wine with your friend.
Yes.
You know, who's a wing woman or a wing man, right?
Wing man, right.
It's a lot easier to go into a cocktail party and the two of you go after meeting people together.
Right.
And what you do is you say, hey, you know, Batabile, I want you to come with me to this association meeting, but my goal for this association meeting is to get introductions to X, Y, and Z.
Yes.
So that you're not just there drinking, okay?
Right.
You're there. Your friend knows that he or she is there to be a wing person for you and is facilitating those introductions.
Right.
But that way you're not out there selling by yourself, because it's hard to sell when you're all alone. It's a lot more enjoyable and it's fun to sell when you have a partner in crime.
And when you have a strategy. That's something that you've mentioned just now that I think is really important to highlight, that going to the event is sort of the first step, but strategizing beforehand. So, for example, some of the networking organizations that I belong to will send out a list the night before of the people who are signed up to attend. And I will actually encourage you to actually Google these people.
Mm-hmm.
Check out their LinkedIn profiles. Learn a little bit of something about them, and I will actually arrive that morning knowing three or four people whom I specifically want to meet.
That's an excellent idea. And even more than that, what I've heard, I haven't done this myself, but what I've heard other folks have done is the reason they send you that list of attendees in advance is so that you could potentially have the opportunity to contact that person in advance and say, hey, you know, Mr. Smith, I'm going to be at this conference, and I really look forward to meeting you there. I'm wondering if you might have 10 minutes to have a cup of coffee in between sessions. And frankly, everybody has time to have coffee in between sessions. And if you go to a conference or any type of event that's fairly large in nature, if they do send that invitation list out in advance, it's your opportunity to ping people in advance so that you have every single coffee break and lunch break scheduled so that you're meeting people who are going to be relevant for you.
And so you're not walking into a situation where it's sort of like being at a high school dance, where it's
not knowing who you're going to get a dance with.
And you're sort of standing there looking around, looking lost and feeling like a real
You want user. Your dance card full before you walk
before
in the door.
Go. Before you go.
And that's
right.
how everybody does
right.
it. That's
right.
how they look like the most popular girl to dance.
There you go. So know what you're looking for. And know who you're looking for.
And do the prep up front. And when you go there, you're going to have way more productivity out of that conference.
Exactly. Right.
So, and now, you did mention we want to talk about people who are unemployed looking for a job and people who maybe are looking at consulting and building a client list.
Creating a job. So let's talk about that too.
And in my mind, they're one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're unemployed looking for a job, you're selling your own skill set. If you are a contractor or a professional service person who has a specific skill that you are offering to a roster of clients, you're selling your own skill set. Now, a difference might be if you are selling a product instead of a service. So let's say you want to open up a restaurant, or let's say you bake the most fabulous cookies on the planet and you want to sell them at the farmer's market. That's a slightly different sales process than selling your services as a lawyer or an accountant or a mediator or anything, or a consultant. But the only difference in my mind is what you need to figure out and understand is, how does the person buying go about finding and qualifying and then taking on a customer or a product? So if you sell cookies, well, who is your customer? Because it might not be the whole world. It might be a very specific segment of the world. And once you know that customer segment, how do they go about finding you? Is it at the grocery store? Is it at the gas station? Is it at the farmer's market? Is it at the those answers to those questions are going to vary depending on what types of cookies you sell, who your customer is, what types of attitudes they have, et cetera.
So you're going to need to know your customer very well.
Absolutely.
In order to know how to be attractive to them. And it brings to mind, you know, I've never been fishing. I'm going to have to. I've read about fishing.
Uh-huh.
And what I've read about fishing is that there are different lures for different kinds of fish.
Yep.
That if you want to catch one kind of fish, you use one kind of lure and perhaps one kind of fishing line. And if you want to catch a different kind of fish, there are different kinds of lures that are interesting to different fish.
Because, yeah, what's attractive to one fish is not necessarily attractive to all fish.
Exactly.
Right?
Right.
And we're all a bunch of fish in this sea.
Right.
So the same thing holds for looking for a job or trying to sell your professional services. You need to understand what your client is. That's why it's very important to be specific. When you get to the coffee talk portion of networking, we mentioned that you need to be specific about what you're looking for, what you offer, who you're trying to connect with, and then how you can help the person on the other side of the table.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get to that level of specificity if you haven't truly vetted out who your customer is.
Okay.
So if you're a marketing consultant, well, that could mean a million different things. But if you say, well, I help traditional businesses be more effective with their social media-based marketing on Facebook, that's a completely different level of specificity. Now you're in a level where people can say, oh, yeah, I have a friend who is afraid of getting on Facebook, and her business could be getting more money from Facebook advertising. Maybe I should put you in touch with her.
Right.
But if you just say you're a marketing consultant.
Right. Exactly.
No one's going to make that connection for you.
I'm going to tell a quick story. I'm going to sort of throw my sister under the bus, poor thing. But this example that you're giving also brings to mind, once she decided to get sort of creative, and she thought that, you know, the canned food would look really cool, that, you know, the shelves would look really cool if they all looked the same.
Mm-hmm.
So she took all the labels off.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got all these cans up there. You
with
know
no
they have
labels.
Food in them. You don't know what's inside.
Yeah.
So a person comes to you and says, I'm a marketing consultant. That's like a can without a label.
That's exactly right. Because you don't know, is it canned peaches? Is it white peaches? Is it yellow peaches?
Is it corn?
Is it in heavy syrup and light syrup?
Exactly.
So there's a lot of
corn. You're right. You're talking about even within the same range of things. You talk just about peaches.
Yep.
You know, I threw corn in there and I thought, wait a minute. We're not even talking about corn. We're talking about varieties of peaches.
Yeah. And so that's how specific you need to be in order to win a customer.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're looking for the right customer to meet your skill set so that you can make them happy at the end of the day.
Right.
If you're not that specific, you're not gonna find anything in a world where it's a buyer's market.
Well, and it is really challenging because, as you noted, the sort of psychological thing is, you know, I just need 8 clients, so I'm going to try to sell to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the advice that I've been given is that you should be so specific about who you're looking for as a client that you should know what they have for breakfast, what do they read for leisure, where do they go on vacation, what kinds of cars do they drive, do they have cars, do they live in a city, do they live in a suburb.
Mm-hmm.
It is important to be very specific and understand exactly what you're looking for.
Now, here's the deal. When somebody if you are very specific about what you're looking for, you're still going to get things outside of your range
from
the people who refer you to business. And what happens is people will say, oh, well, here's a lead, and that could be someone who is completely unrelated to what you have to offer. What that does is it – there are two things. What that does is it gives you information on how you could maybe potentially be more specific in the future. Because if someone gave you a lead that's completely off in left field from what you're looking to do, you're not communicating what you offer clearly and effectively.
Right.
The number two, and very important in my mind, is you need to follow up on that lead.
Mm-hmm.
Because
oh, yes.
if you follow up on that lead, you are being respectful to the person who gave you the lead. If you don't follow up on it, that person will never give you another lead
mm-hmm.
because it reflects badly on him or her. But you need to follow up on that lead, and it might actually give you an idea of maybe you should be servicing this off in left field client. So when you're looking for eight clients and just trying to get eight clients in the door, being specific will actually help you broaden, in some cases, your positioning or refocus your positioning from your initial hunch. And more often than not, a person's initial hunch on where their specific target is wrong.
Sure.
It's usually your second or your third time around the merry-go-round that you actually get to where there is a market for what you have to offer. So using that information that you get back is very helpful and very informative. The final thing that I would say is that you cannot be afraid of rejection.
Yes.
And
very
you will
important.
Be rejected and rejected and rejected and rejected
right.
over and over
right.
again.
Right.
And
right.
this is why we started off the conversation with figure out how you can cut your expenses down. Look at your budget and cut whatever you can cut.
Because it's going to take time.
Because it's going to take time, and everything takes longer. If you think it's going to take a year, it's going to take a year and a half.
Do you know
everything
takes
longer?
Why Formula 409 is called Formula 409?
No.
Because the other 408 didn't work.
There you go.
Okay. It took 409 times to get it right.
To get that one right.
And so the important thing, though, is not to get discouraged by each try that doesn't work, because each try teaches you something, if you allow it to.
That's right.
Each try will teach you something, and so the next time you go and do it, you're doing it as a much better informed person.
And more importantly, or as important in my opinion, is looking at your budget and cutting it to the bone.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you have to remember is that cutting your budget down gives you the peace of mind when you're out there looking to sell something
right.
so that you're not under the gun to sell something to pay off certain expenses.
Exactly.
And I'll say a lot of people look at their budget. When they're employed, they look at their budget and they say, oh, well, I can't possibly live without that massage once a month, or I can't possibly live without this, you know, vacation to wherever every year.
Right.
Well, you have to remember that those things increase the amount of money you need to bring in. And if you're a consultant or if you're looking for a job, it only increases the stress that you have in getting something now
and
not being able to wait.
That stress comes through when you're trying
Absolutely.
To sell. People can tell.
People can tell.
And it kind of drives, it can drive people away.
It's without question a detractor.
Uh-huh.
So that's why cutting your expenses down will help you feel like you have time. And
right.
feel like you have the cushion necessary to not be under the gun.
Right, right.
And so it all works together. And it's all, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to take some time. But if you are out there trying to figure out how people are hiring in this market, maybe not a lot, but people are hiring. And you have to figure out how you can use your relationship so that you're not in the pile, how you can figure out how you can help the other person so that you're establishing and demonstrating your credibility and your skill set. And then ultimately, you have to put yourself in a position where you're not under the gun so that you can wait for the right thing to come along.
Right. Wonderful. Pankaj, thank you so much. That was a great wrap-up of the topics that we've talked about today. And it looks like mainly it's a helpful guide for folks who are contemplating perhaps having to be in the job market and don't want to live a life that is sort of in fear of losing your job. Sometimes you can psych yourself out and end up doing that because you're so stressed out
yeah.
about keeping your job. About folks who are in the job market, how they can stand out and perhaps get the job over the other 299 people who have sent in their resumes. And then finally, for people who are creating work,
mm-hmm.
how they can stand out and not be afraid of selling.
Mm-hmm. And one last thing that I would say is that if you do find yourself unemployed for a fairly long period of time, or if you're already unemployed and you find yourself, you know, approaching wit's end, you know, you want to pull your hair, I don't have any hair on my head, but you want to pull your hair out, then what you also need to do is just accept the fact that you're not alone in this world going through that. This is a very difficult time, and acceptance of the situation, it's not easy and it's not the preferable path to take, but if you can somehow find that acceptance of the path that we've been given, then it'll help you kind of pick up, you know, dust yourself off and get out there again, because you got to keep on getting yourself out there.
That's
get back
right.
up on the ski slope and go down the slope again, even if you fell down
exactly.
the time
fall
before.
Down five times, get up six.
Exactly.
All right. Wonderful. Well, on that note, thank you again for being here, and I look forward to the next time when we can talk about more topics about how to be successful in this economy.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, everyone. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Please join me again next week for a brand new topic. I leave you now with more from Roz Moshe's Into the Cosmic Blue Night Forest. Have a wonderful week. Thank you.